Tengo un tío cajonero que hace caja y calaja y cajita y cajones, y al tirar de los cordones salen caja y calaja y cajita y cajones.
Radiofonica. Tre giorni di Radio Arte dallo Spazio O a Milano. Irene Revel, A Historical Perspective Towards New Production, on Danish composer and radio author Else Marie Pad and her noise archive.
Hello? Is that too loud? Not loud enough. So I'm just drinking, for the benefit of people that aren't in the room, I'm drinking this drink that looks like fizzy water, but actually it's full of sugar. So let's see what happens. Thank you. It's really an honor to share these days with all of you. And a special thank you to Anna and Alessandro for initiating such a brilliant project, and Sarah and Owe for lending it a home, and I think also a context, and of course Radio Papese for putting it all on the radio. And I must say I'm quite intimidated by being in such esteemed company. During our first roundtable discussion on Thursday morning, many of us claim to be interlopers or misfits in this group, but I really think I can win that prize. I run Electra, which is an organization based in London, or if you like, a curatorial practice that carries out projects that have unusual shapes or rhythms, often research-based. But although we've worked with sounds, and we've certainly worked across a whole range of different kinds of institutional contexts and venues, I've never directly curated works for the radio myself. And I'm also not Italian, so apologies that this talk is in English. My reason for joining is that I'm already here in Milan throughout this autumn, based at or attached to O on a curatorial residency program called RES, funded by the Fondazione Adolfo Pini, so I also have them to thank. And as it happens, one of the future projects, one of the future Electra projects I'm starting to think about more whilst I'm here, is concerning the work of Danish radio composer Else Marie Pade, which will involve working with radio and indeed commissioning works for radio. And so Radiofonica seemed like a wonderful and incredibly generous opportunity for me to immerse myself more in thoughts about what it means to work with radio, and in particular to commission work for radio. I'm going to give you a very brief biographical introduction to Else Marie Pade and play some brief extracts of her work, including a film portrait of her made by the Danish artists Henriette Heise and Jakob Jakobsen, which I'll end with. And I'll also try to pose some very brief initial questions that I'm asking myself about this project. First, though, I'm going to give a brief introduction to the Hernois Archive project, as it's a major facet of mine and Electra's work over the last 10 years or more, and it's also the reason I became aware of Else Marie Pade's work. And inevitably, in some senses, it's also the starting point for this new project. So Hernois, the Hernois project, was initiated by two women, Lina Juverovic and Anna Hilden Essert, a curator and a writer respectively, in 2001, with an ambition to investigate music and sound histories in relation to gender and to create a lasting resource in this area through building up an archive. I don't want to delve into this so much, but more give you a chronology of the project and how it's developed over the years. We actually together made a documentary in 2006 that looked at the motivations for the project in some detail, and that's available on Ubu Web. It's called Hernois, The Making Of. So one very simple way of framing the project is that Lina and Anna felt that in their own development, they'd been hugely influenced by the work of certain women. So you see some of them in this slide here, Diamanda Galash, Lydia Lunch, and the Riot Girl band Bikini Kill. And yet in their curatorial work, they were encountering and ultimately programming or curating mostly the work of men. So they set out to attempt to turn this around, to look for historical oversights or blind spots, as well as the women artists working in the present who they weren't already encountering. And to some extent, I think it's fair to say it was also a reaction to several canonical survey exhibitions that had taken place around that time, like Sonic Process at the Centre Pompidou and Sonic Boom at the Hayward in London. So in 2005, Lina and Anna co-curated the exhibition Hernois, building on their research, which took place at South London Gallery, also with events at Tate Modern and an electrical walk by Christina Kubisch at the Goethe Institute in London. And by this point, I'd started working for them. So the exhibition gathered, I would say, quite diverse international artists and included newly commissioned works by King Gordon and Jutta Kurter, Emma Hedditch, Christina Kubisch, Kath Matthews, Hayley Newman, and Marina Rosenfeld, as well as a series of talks and performances. The Hernoys Archive, as it became called, formed the backbone of the Hernoys exhibition and was developed by the curators in collaboration with Emma Hedditch, one of the artists, and myself. Made publicly initially during this exhibition at South London Gallery, the archive contains the collected research materials, video interviews, and performance footage recorded by the curators and a number of guests during the development of the project. It also includes books, fanzines, records, CDs, catalogues, and other ephemera. And also we've continued to carry out these video interviews since 2005. So there's a growing number of interviews. The exhibition was very popular and really seemed to bring together a new community of people for the first time. There was even actually a six-part radio program that the artist and musician Melanie Clifford produced called Hernoys Radio for Resonance FM, and you can find that on hernoys.org, which I'll talk about very soon. Certain elements of the project toured over the following years, and then in 2010, the archive was donated to CRISAP, which is the Creative Research into Sound Arts Practice Group at the London College of Communication. So the archive now finds its permanent home in the University of the Arts, London, Archives and Special Collections, which, curiously, it sits exactly next to the Stanley Kubrick archive there. So this donation marked a move to actualize the initial desire of the Hernoys project to create a lasting resource, but also operates as a starting point for new investigations. Firstly, the creation of a blog, hernoys.org, which was mainly put together by a researcher, Holly Ingleton, who also worked on the cataloguing of the archive. And that hosts many digital elements of the project, including most of the video interviews and documentation like the radio series I mentioned. It also has responses to the archive from a whole range of invited practitioners who are asked to pick and discuss one item in the archive and one item that's not in the archive, but they feel should be. The latter, an attempt to show the inevitable limitations of such a collection and also potentially acquire new materials. So this slide has a contribution from Tara Rogers, where she's picked out Daphne Oram's book, An Individual Note. Secondly, since 2012, the students studying the MA in Sound Arts at LCC, CRISAP, now make their first piece of coursework in response to the archive, which has been a way to introduce feminist theory, but also discussions of wider critical frameworks and notions of the archive and canonicity to the students. And in fact, Anna Raimondo made a brilliant piece of work in this capacity herself. Thirdly, we also marked this donation with an event series that we jointly presented, that's CRISAP and Electra, at Tate Modern called Hernoys, Feminisms and the Sonic in 2012. Here we invited Pauline Oliveros to give a keynote talk, and we also staged in the Turbine Hall a performance of her 1970 work to Valerie Solanas and Marilyn Monroe in recognition of their desperation. Her talk itself actually was an incredible example of challenging historical hierarchies and her own historicization. She spent the first few minutes really only talking about her own work and the score that was going to be performed later, and then she gave over most of her hour to introduce the work of seven younger women composers, diverting her status to the work of younger, lesser-known figures. We also invited a great project by the curator Isla Lever Yap around the legacy of Meredith Monk called The Voice as a Language. And finally, we had a day-long symposium with a very exciting combination of contributors. If you can't see because you're listening at home, names as diverse as Uta Mehta Bauer, Sonia Boyce, Maggie Nichols, Nina Power, but many others. So these events led to further collaborative research into Pauline Oliveros and her feminist thinking and their wider historical moment in the 1970s. Amongst other things, this led us to discovering this very intriguing self-published collection of performance scores, women's work, which was put together by Alison Knowles and Janaea Lockwood in 1975. Some of this we explored most recently in an exhibition at the Badischer Kunstverein in 2013 called Slow Runner, named after the Pauline Oliveros work, Rose Mountain Slow Runner, which is performed in her episode of Robert Ashley's Music with Roots in the Ether, which was a key work in the exhibition. And you can see a still from that. And then in this image, you can see a new commission by the artist Emma Hedich, who'd worked previously on the archive as well. It's a visual performance score comprising of these posters. And also Liz Rhodes' work, Dresden Dynamo, exhibited in this context as she turned to film and particularly to optical sound in the late 60s in a quite, I would say, political attempt to produce noise. So we've continued to work on these questions, including attempting to formulate a specific question or set of questions around what a feminist performance score could be. And this was the topic of a recent workshop we hosted in London, departing from the collection Women's Work that we saw in the previous slide. And here's an image from a garden where we were performing one of Pauline Oliveros's sonic meditations in the workshop. On that note, I'd like to share very briefly extracts from two texts that have been key for me in thinking about history, historicization, the canon, or other ways of working with history, especially with this work on the Hanoi's archive. I'm aware both of these quotes relate to the history of visual arts more than sound, and also to feminist history specifically, but I hope they're helpful to articulate some more general questions about doing history or working with historical moments and how we might challenge existing ideas of the canon and historicization productively from the present. The first quotation is a brief extract from Liz Rhodes' 1978 text, Whose History? You saw her work in the previous screen. She's a British artist filmmaker who's been active in the 1960s up until the present. This text was written for the catalogue of a major survey exhibition, Film as Film, that happened at the Hayward Gallery in London in the late 70s. Film as Film was an exhibition that attempted to map the whole history of artist moving image up to that point, obviously an impossible endeavour. So Liz Rhodes, with a group of fellow women artists, was involved in a committee working on the exhibition. There were a number of committees programming it, and theirs was specifically to research women's role in this history. And part of that work involved research into early film and, really importantly, the restitution of figures such as Alice Ski, Germaine Dulac, and Maya Deren, all of whom were more or less forgotten at that point. But ultimately, the committee decided to withdraw their research from the exhibition, contributing only a text to the catalogue, in which they explain their withdrawal and their frustration at what they saw as an exercise in canonization, which they felt ran counter to their feminist approaches. And this text by Liz Rhodes, Whose History, then appears alongside this group explanation as a more personal account of the withdrawal. So she says, "It is as though a line could be drawn between the past and present." And here she's describing the canonical approach of the exhibition, or more generally, the traditional way of historicizing artworks. "It is as though a line could be drawn between the past and present, and pieces of a person's life and work pegged onto it. No exceptions, no change. Theory looks nice, the similarity of the item reassuring. Shirt to shirt, shoulder to shoulder, an inflexible chain, each part in place. The pattern is defined. Cut the line and chronology falls in a crumpled heap. I prefer a crumpled heap, history at my feet, not stretched above my head." So for me, this text and the wider history of the exhibition around it seems invaluable in an understanding of the need and importance of drawing one's own historical context. which is inevitably a fragmented mess, but the embracing of these complications. So both the absolute necessity of drawing on history or finding one's own history, but also a playful irreverence towards the very notion of history and the canon. And the second text, I've been very greatly influenced by recently is art historian Catherine Grant's essay, Fans of Feminism. For me, this text is very much a recent companion piece to the Liz Rhodes text. And in the essay, she looks at the recent resurgence of interest in feminism, in particular in the feminist art of the 1970s, also called second wave feminism. She's particularly interested in the influences this work has had on a younger generation of artists working now. And she uses the model of the fan or fandom to consider these intergenerational influences. So I'm just going to read you a brief quote, but I urge you to look at the whole essay if you're interested. So she says, different moments in history can hopefully be articulated in ways that do not collapse into a golden political past and an apathetic present. Rather than an appropriation strategy that privileges irony and distance, the action of a fan focuses on attachment and desire. However, being a fan of feminism also maintains the difference between historical moments and what might be at stake in replaying historical modes of feminist activity and art. So what this idea of being a fan does is challenges more traditional ideas of influence or intergenerational influence, which often are based on psychoanalytic models like transference or the mother-daughter relation. And instead, it stresses the idea of desire through a perhaps queerer or non-academic or anti-virtuosic idea, this idea of being a fan, which anyone could potentially be. So let's cut to Elsa Marie Pardé, and I'm going to start straight away by playing you an extract. It's not perhaps her most well-known work, but it's something that really struck me on first hearing. And for me, given her very institutional role working in Danish national radio, feels like it really emphasizes the kind of subversion she managed to introduce there. The work is called Face It from 1970. It's available on one of the three commercially available CDs of her work that have been issued in the past decade or so. And I heard it first in a slightly different configuration at the Danish National Archives, where the piece is a soundtrack to a series of spoken word poetry pieces by a Danish poet, Orla Bundgaard Povlsen. And here, in the extract, we're going to listen to the looped spoken word, which I think roughly translates as Hitler is not dead, is a repeated line from what is actually a longer series of poems. It's something that Elsa Marie describes as being a song of the Americans in Vietnam. Hitler er ikke død. 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 Hitler er ikke død.
Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død. Hitler ikke død.
Elsa Marie Pardee was a figure who emerged for me during the initial assembling of the Hernoy's archive in 2005. The artists Henrietta Heise and Jakob Jakobsen at that time ran a project called the Copenhagen Free University, and they were making a film about Pardee for an online television station in Copenhagen. And they wanted to know if we'd like a copy of this film for the archive, and of course we did. It seemed that Elsa Marie Pardee was a quite well-known figure in Denmark at that point, though not so much internationally, which has happened much more recently, I think. Elsa Marie was born in 1924, and there are two quite compelling stories about her childhood that circulate. The first concerns a repeated stint of illness where she spent many months in bed with a window that was too high for her to look out of in her immobile state, effectively instilling in her, from an early age, a very eager listening practice as she spent many hours and days imagining the scenes outside through the auditory fragments. The second is as a young woman during Nazi occupation of Denmark, where she participated with a number of friends in the underground resistance movement. She was part of an all-female weapons training and explosives group and was ultimately caught and imprisoned in 1944, which again created a sustained period of solitude and listening. She trained as a composer after the war and became very influenced by Pierre Schaeffer and took her first job at the Danish National Radio. She's often described as Denmark's first electronic composer, and her work is sometimes characterized as being at the intersection of both music concrete and synthesis. It seems very important to emphasize that her initial composition work for Danish radio, she was not paid to produce nor given time and space to produce it. Rather, she managed to carve out moments and obtain help from technicians to make her work effectively outside of hours or outside of her job description as a producer, which she would then almost furtively insert into quite unexpected contexts. For instance, the children's story, The Little Mermaid, which was one of her best-known works from the late 50s. She attended the summer school in Darmstadt and by all accounts became quite close to Stockhausen and went on in the mid-1960s to invite him and other figures, in particular the European Fluxus movement, to Danish National Radio. And here's a couple of slides that are extracts from the catalogue at the Danish National Radio Archives. This is a program that was broadcasting a performance by Charlotte Moorman and Namjoon Paik that took place in Copenhagen in 1966. And this one, I think, seems to be from directly from Darmstadt. Unfortunately, I can't play any of these programs because of copyright reasons. So I'm very struck by her role as an establishment figure, someone who really persisted and perhaps subverted from within the institution. The anecdote that perhaps best relates this is her insistence that she really absolutely had to fight for these opportunities and often had to take, as she put it, unexpected arguments or positions. This is what she described in an interview we conducted with her. In particular, one example she gave is of drawing on quite nationalistic arguments that a small country like Denmark needed to keep up with the advancements being made in Germany or France, that experimentation was a matter of national pride. I find it fascinating that through her almost secretive but also quite pragmatic approach, she was able to remain within and even influence a large conservative institution, and most importantly, to carry on making her work there throughout her entire career. She worked at Danish National Radio right until her retirement. So there's something for me compelling about her status as an insider rather than an outsider. After being invited to work on this by SNUK, the Society for New Musique in Denmark, I made an initial research trip to Copenhagen in 2013, where I spent some time in the National Radio Archives and had the chance to actually meet Else Marie, conducting an interview, albeit via translation. I'd then spoken at length with Jakob Kierkegaard, who has himself done an extraordinary project with Else Marie, which, amongst other things, precipitated her first live performance in her late 80s. So I've spoken to him about how to approach this, and one thing that became very clear is that as really almost all of her work was made for radio, the project absolutely had to be a project on the radio. So we've partnered with Resonance FM in London, and part of the project, we hope, will simply include the broadcasting of as much of her body of work as we can. But there's also the question of involving a younger generation of practitioners, which naturally involves commissioning for the radio. But perhaps more than just works for the radio, works that actually challenge that medium, and how to do that in a way that's sympathetic to Else Marie's approach to that medium, where she was both a pioneer and part of an institution. How can the medium of radio, indeed state radio, be subverted now? How can her body of work be sensitively mediated and honoured? And what does it mean to speak about her in terms of feminism, a framework she hasn't necessarily cast herself, although she was very aware of her position as a woman in a very conservative environment? It's certainly interesting to note that some of the best-known women composers from this era were working in radio, particularly in England, Daphne Oram and Delia Derbyshire. Okay, I'm going to stop now and just leave you with, for as much time as we've got left, some of this film from Henriette Heiser and Jakob Jakobsen, the title of which is EMP 1810-2005, or Else Marie Pardé, 18th of October 2005, if you want a long or short version. And in it, you'll hear some of her best-known works as well.